Are you tired of using subpar fertilizer that don't give your crops the boost they need? Look no further than Irish Shite, the all-natural and sustainable solution for your farm. Made from the finest blend of Irish animal waste, Irish Shite provides essential nutrients for your crops to thrive. And it's not just good for your crops, it's also good for your skin. With Irish Shite, you'll look 10 years younger. So why settle for less? Choose Irish Shite. It's made right here in Ireland. And be sure to tell your friends and fellow farmers about the power of Irish manure. This message has been brought to you by the Irish Shite Association, the natural choice for a sustainable farm.
Do you know when you're like, you're falling off to sleep and you just have a memory of something really embarrassing?
Yeah. Like every
night. Every so often I remember playing Gaelic football in school, and halftime came. Obviously, you're playing the other way, and we immediately sort of turned over, and the ball came to me, and I started playing my own side, and I thought, "This is great! I'm getting a real run at them." And everyone was shouting, like, the other way. Oh, no. And I just have a flashback to that thinking, this is humiliating.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favorite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host, Will, a writer of three films plus a Christmas special, and I'm joined again by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films and three and a bit episodes of TV, Kevin Lehan. Kevin, how are you?
I'm grand, Will. How are you?
I am kind of emotionally broken, I would say.
Good. If we don't cry by the end of this episode, then we are absolute failures. This has got to be the most upsetting episode of a podcast that's ever put out.
I guarantee you this is going to be the one episode where we'll actually be in hysterics by the end of it. And we'll, whatever pick I'll have, we'll end up going, I can never watch that pick again because now I've just ruined it for myself and for everyone else. That's what's going to end up happening here now today.
Good.
Oh, God. Kevin, let's tell people what this whole thing is about. What's the show about? What's the format?
The show is we talk about our favourite scenes based on whatever randomly generated topics come up on this big wheel that we have. We've got about 300 on there. We spin it at the end of the show. Last week, I spun it for you. And we got best tearjerker. The week before, you spun it for me, and we got best sex scene. So that's really what it's all about, really. We just get to sort of focus in on something quite macro. And this week, as I said, it's best tearjerker scenes. The scenes that, without fail, make you cry. So,
as I said last week, we've gone from one bodily fluid to another type of bodily fluid.
We have the Kleenex here.
But like we're the thematic connective tissue is if it wasn't completely accidental is genius.
It's completely. It's the first accidental. Time I've been described as that. Random chance. Well, so far, it's been working out in our favor. So I'm really curious to find out what is going to come up at the end of this episode. But before we get into that, I suppose we need to get through tearjerker scenes.
Yeah, and I, like, you know, listen, I've done exhaustive and extensive research on tearjerkers, but Kevin, I'd like to ask you, what have you had to think about? What films make some eye juice squirt out of your tear duct?
That's a horrible eye juice. God, I have. I've come up with three, right, and I was trying to whittle it down. But the first one that came to my mind, and I wanted to throw this back at you because it's sort of like, it's unique in that I've never read a screenplay that's made me cry aside from this one scene in this one script. And it's from Good Will Hunting, and it's the It's Not Your Fault scene.
Don't fuck with me. It's not your fault.
Don't fuck with me, all right? Don't fuck with me, Sean, not you.
It's not your fault.
I remember reading that script while I was in college, and I hadn't seen the film yet, and I was just sort of like going through it because it was Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, and they were the It Boys at the time, and you know, there was all this buzz about them being up for the Academy Award for screenplay and what have you, and I read the script, and I got to that scene. It buckled me. I was like in bits reading that scene, and I've never cried at a script since. But have you ever cried reading a script?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All written by some writer called Will Collins.
Well, I didn't want to say it, but there's that scene from Creed when he gets knocked out and he doesn't get back up again until he has that tiny little memory of his dad. And then he's brought into the corner and Stallone is talking to him and he's basically wanting to pull him out of the fight because he saw his dad get killed. And it's like the whole movie just sort of turns on that moment. Mm-hmm. And it's something that wasn't in the screenplay. It was something that Stallone added to it. But that had me ugly crying.
Closing seconds of the fight. Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
But the one that, you know, when I was like thinking of it to mention on this, I was even getting emotional thinking about it. And it's the moment in Iron Giant when...
Yeah.
You know, that was written by Brad Bird. It was adapted mm-hmm. from a book, but Brad Bird sort of brought his own life experience into it. And, you know, famously, his sister was murdered. And
I didn't know this. What?
Oh, well, yeah, that's the background to the movie. It's that his sister was murdered and he pitched it to Warner Brothers, the adaptation, as what if a gun had a soul? And what if a gun didn't want to be a weapon and it didn't want to hurt anybody? And so... The whole story of that is this weapon that is programmed to destroy doesn't want to because of the love of a boy. And it boils down to like that moment at the end where he's saying to him, you are whatever you choose to be. Yeah. And he goes off to basically sacrifice himself to save the town that's afraid of him, but to also save the boy that loved him.
You are who you choose to be.
And he just has that little memory in his head as he's sort of like flying towards destruction.
Yeah.
It's like, you are whatever you choose to be. And he's like Superman. And
I didn't know that.
And yeah, but that really always makes me choke up.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I didn't know that about his sister. That's horrific. God.
Yeah, gun violence. It was her husband that shot her dead. And
oh, my God.
So you can see like when in that movie when they're talking about like souls never die and... Yeah, it's got lots of sentiment if you go back and watch the film, but it's a beautiful film, and not many people that I know of have watched it. It sort of passed them by, and it's my favorite Brad Bird film. Those are my picks, but I'm desperate to hear what yours are.
So when I got Tearjerker, I kind of jumped the gun a little bit and said I know what it's going to be. And then I started doing research and then I went, I have no idea what this is going to be. Because it's a weird one, because then I started going down the kind of the personal, because I have to get a little bit personal about this. I started to think about, like, you know, what was the first film I remember crying to? Like, what's the first film that made me cry? And for me, it was, without question, E.T., Mm-hmm. And I remember getting really emotional the time when E.T. dies, you know, where he obviously comes back to life. But then I remember at the end when Elliot has to say goodbye to E.T. and I was just in floods of tears. And it's a very powerful moment.
It's beautiful.
It's really, really, really stunningly beautiful. And the more I go back to that film, the more I kind of analyze that film, it's the more heart-wrenching it is, because ultimately that's about Spielberg dealing with the divorce of his parents. And there's a real, even though he didn't write the screenplay, Melissa Madison did, it was a close collaboration. And it's, you know, and when there's something subconscious about that film, as in it doesn't feel forced, or the emotion doesn't feel manufactured, and as a result there's something subconscious that the filmmakers put into it that, like, you know, connects with us on a subconscious, an equally subconscious level that we empathize with.
It does that thing as well where it ends on a close-up of a face, and a lot of the really most moving endings for me, most recently being like Call Me By Your Name, just end on that close-up of a face that's just been fundamentally changed by the experiences of the film. They always get to me, where you just burrow right down to it's that character that everything has altered within, and the empathy of sort of seeing that up close, it just sort of can bring you to tears. But I love E.T.'s ending. I think it's so gorgeous.
So I started to what was the joy about this was actually trying to dissect the it's not a genre, but like break down the category of tearjerkers, right? And it really kind of hasn't been done. You can look online for tearjerkers and you'll get like Hello Magazine's website giving you the 25 best tearjerkers to cry your eyes out to, right?
What do they pick? I bet Terms of Endearment and Steel Magnolias.
It's everything that came out in the last 10 years. Like they don't go anywhere beyond 2010. You know,
when Iron Man said, "I'm Iron Man." Floods.
I went and I kind of broke down the tearjerker into subcategories. All right.
Okay.
And a kind of an interesting kind of pattern started to form. And this is, and I'm gonna share with you my kind of my discoveries. So, the first category of tearjerker is the lost love or the unrequited love tearjerker, right?
Okay.
And those include films like The Remains of the Day, which I just adore, with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. I just think that's a beautiful film.
Mr. Stevens, don't you wait. That bus is always late. Come in out of the wet.
You must take good care of yourself, Mrs. Benn.
You too, Mr. Stevens. Promise me that.
Oh, yes, I promise. You must try to do all you can to make these years happy ones for yourself and for your husband. We may never meet again, Mrs. Benn. That is why I'm permitting myself to be so personal, if you will forgive me.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Oh, here it comes. It's on time for once.
La La Land is a lost love story. Casablanca is included in that. The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Brokeback Mountain definitely is in that category, but it also goes into another character we have later on.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
So, my next category, right, of tearjerkers, right? So these are all my subcategories.
Okay.
Is the category of parents doing their damn best tearjerkers. So these are parents who are just trying to be good parents in the world. And films in this category are films like Finding Nemo, where even Nemo's dad just doing everything he can to find his son.
That's a gorgeous one.
It's beautiful. Another one, In the Name of the Father, which is, you know...
That's also a gorgeous film.
And beautiful, really.
Harrowing.
To kill a Mockingbird, which is just a dad, the ultimate dad, Gregory Peck, just trying to do his best in the world
and being
a good dad.
Yeah.
The Royal Tenenbaums. There's a beautiful moment in The Royal Tenenbaums.
What's his name?
Spark Plug.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've had a rough year, Dad.
I know you have, Chazzy.
had a tough year, Dad, and it's, there's nothing else, and I'm in bits, but not like floods of tears. I'm not ugly tears, but it's enough to make me go, that's just the right amount of
sincerity.
Emotion I'm getting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was just right for that film, you know. Another one which had me in floods of tears was Arrival. I bawled my eyes out in Arrival. Mm. And so the next subcategory I'm going into is one that you've already brought up, which is the sports underdog tearjerker category.
That's the one which always gets me. I couldn't give a shit about parents doing their best. It's it's about whether the underdog can actually score the touchdown, and I don't know anything about football, but for some reason, it always just sort of tugs at my heartstrings.
Yeah, like Rocky, you've already brought up Rocky, Rocky series. He really got that kind of formula working well.
I think that is the magic formula with the Rocky series, is that, you know, there's some sense of trauma in all those films, and it's about how he overcomes it. And from the first film onwards, they just always sort of like the best of that series sort of have you crying and allowing, giving you the freedom to actually cry and root for Rocky. But yeah, it's Stallone is a clever man.
Mm-hmm. The Wrestler is another one of those films that kind of is in that sports underdog tearjerkers. I really like that one. And the next category is, this was a really interesting one. This was one that was kind of, I got from reading a lovely article by Roger Ebert. And Roger Ebert said that, you always raised a quote. What's the quote you always have that Roger Ebert had?
Oh, he's the one that said that films are empathy machines.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that really sums up. For me, it's like the two types of emotions that are most sort of pulled out of me when watching a really good film is laughter or tears. I don't tend to get scared by movies anymore, and thrillers, it's a lesser sort of peak on the emotional spectrum. But if a film can make you cry or it can make you laugh, I feel like that's a real talent, and it's just down to the empathy of the filmmakers, I think.
I read an article that Roger Ebert wrote, and he wrote about how he doesn't cry in films at the sad moments. He cries when he sees good people doing well.
He nailed it. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
It's never about the sadness. It's about how you, as Rocky said, pick yourself back up and keep going.
Yeah. And he described it's a beautiful word. These are it's a sense of elevation. And these are, and I'm calling this subcategory elevation tearjerkers. Tears that are brought on through acts of kindness or goodness elevating the spirit. And films that I would include in that are, I would say, It's a Wonderful Life.
Up here in a blizzard.
Hurry now, Mr. Bamford in New York.
Oh, I left right in the middle of it as soon as I got Mary's telegram. Good idea, Ernie, a toast. To my big brother, George, the richest man in town.
Like, Pixar have been particularly good at pulling the old heartstrings. They've up, and I would say WALL-E as well is one of those films that is, it kind of has elevation tears about, you know, at the end of the story where kind of characters kind of pull together to rescue WALL-E and, you know, revive him, really. The next subcategory I've come up with is the coming of age friendship tearjerker subcategory, and these type of films are films about friendship, about coming of age. And in this category, I'm putting in films like Stand By Me.
Oh yeah.
In all our lives, there's a fall from innocence, a time after which we are never the same.
There's an ache that you feel throughout that film.
But that's one where you don't cry at anything you see in the film. It's you cry when the film ends. It's when that song begins and the end credits, you just have this sense of loss where it's like you feel like you've lost something, but it was such a beautiful like story. So that's an interesting one, because there's not really a scene in that where it would make you cry. It's just, it's the whole film as it wraps up.
Yeah, where you learn, and I don't want to spoil it, but like, you know, it's the kind of, there's a closing narration that's very pivotal to how we process them walking away at the end of the story, which spins, reframes the end of this adventure in a way that's just devastating. And I'm like in bits. I just, yeah, it's a beautiful film and holds up. Well, Kevin, let me take you on to the next subcategory, right? And I think you might relate to this, right? I'm calling it the There's a Good Boy tearjerkers. These are tearjerkers that brought on, you know, from having a relationship between a character and their absolutely wonderful, amazing pet.
The devoted dog.
Their devoted dog or special alien creature, Mac and me. I'm referencing E.T. I'm referencing My Dog Skip, which is one of those weird little kind of like late 90s, 2000 films that I remember seeing.
The dog of your boyhood teaches you a great deal about friendship and love and death.
I was an only child.
He was an only dog.
Okay, my next subcategory is the real-life endurance tearjerkers. So these are kind of like stories that are set in real life or based in real life, but they're about human endurance and the ability for humans to survive in extraordinary circumstances. So it's kind of like tears of relief of like, I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you're alive tears. So I'm kind of like, I'm going to reference like films like 12 Years a Slave, 127 Hours, Apollo 13. There's a release. There's a relief at the end.
That's
of
a good one.
You know? Yeah. Captain Phillips.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. The ending of that where he's getting checked out by the ship's nurse or the ship's doctor. And I think she was an actual real, you know, it was a person playing themselves essentially and what they would do. So it's very real and there's lots of verisimilitude in that.
Okay, we're going to lay you down, okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I want you to lay down nice and gently. Nice and gently, okay? You're okay. I got you. There you go. Very good. Captain, you're safe now, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Does my family know?
Your family knows you're safe. And you will be able to call them as soon as you are taken care of.
But yeah, him just realizing he's just been through hell and that guy that he was beginning to slightly empathize with has been killed.
Yeah, it's devastating. It's truly, truly beautiful. I think it's wonderful. But I want to bring us on to my final category, and this is the granddaddy category. Okay, this is the behemoth. This is the Godzilla.
Is this the one where your pick is going to come from?
No. No, but I'm talking about tearjerkers, and I'm talking about, I'm measuring this on a scale of emotional trauma.
Okay.
So I think the granddaddy tearjerker subcategory is the one to beat them all, the one to shed the most tears, the tears that have the greatest volume, is the subcategory in where we have the death of a dearly beloved character in the film. And those are the tears that really kill us. I'm going to reference films like My Girl. Mm-hmm. I think that brings heavy, heavy tears. The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. I remember seeing that with my wife. And we went to a late night screening. And she was still crying the following morning.
My God.
She woke up crying about The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. The Champ. Both versions of The Champ.
Can't wake up! Wake up! Wake up!
Yeah, it's rough. Philadelphia. So I think that if you have this type of tears at the end of the film, it's more impactful. But Philadelphia at the end, you know, it's just, they're ugly. This is like the ugly tears category, you know?
It's the good kind of cheese. Sort of like Philadelphia cheese.
Yeah. So these are the granddaddy tearjerkers. Those are the ones that, you know, cry, make you cry the ugly tears. And if you end your film with that, with this type of like elicitation of emotion, you know, expect your audience to be traumatized for, you know, days afterwards. But I feel that if you're playing with fire, if you don't nail it, it can go wrong for you. You know, as
cheesy and sort of manipulative. Yeah.
You know what made you such a great dog is you loved us every day, no matter what. That's an amazing thing.
But Kevin, I want to bring you on a journey into my pick, right?
I'm ready. I've got the Kleenex. I'm ready.
You've got the Kleenex ready. Oh God! And I listen. I don't want to make you cry. This isn't. It's not from the kind of the ugly tears category. But it certainly is one that's very personal for me. It's the first I remember. I saw this when I was about 13, maybe. Okay. And my next door neighbor, Shirley Crimmon, we were kind of like.
Well, I know Shirley. How is she?
You know, she is doing great, and she said that.
I don't think people get that running joke where I just anytime a name comes up, I just say I know them.
Kevin knows nobody. But Shirley, we were kind of like film buddies growing up. So if Shirley rented a film. If either of us rented films, we kind of swapped them. So we would kind of like double up on we would never rent the same film.
Oh, dude, you're just bringing back a memory. We used to do that as friends as well. Wow, I completely forgot that.
It was great.
We'd each rent something else and then we'd swap it over the weekend before I had to go back.
Yeah. It was so great. Or go up to each, or call each other and say, come here, I got this film, like a new release. We got it. It's like, yes. And you'd literally just like pick up your plate of chips and just smash them against the wall. And you say, ma'am, I'm gone. Shirley's got Alien 3, you know? She was also the person who told me the entire plot of The Abyss before I ever saw The Abyss. And sold it to me so well. Like, you know, I was like going, wow, I don't need to see it anymore. So we were kind of those kind of buddies. But anyway, Shirley got the call from Shirley. Says, new film, I think you should really watch it. And I remember it was a summer's day. So I headed up. We sat down. And she put on for me Cinema Paradiso. And it was my first foreign language film. I'd never watched a film with subtitles before. And, you know, I rewatched it last night, and it's a lovely, lovely, lovely gem of a film. It really is. The first half of it is utterly perfect. I truly believe it's absolutely perfect. To give people an idea of it, I'm sure everyone listening to this knows exactly what this film is. But I think, and also, I got to warn everyone, I'm going to spoil the hell out of this film as well, because my scene is the very last scene of the film. But the plot of Cinema Paradiso is that it's set in Italy, and it's about this. You know, a successful filmmaker. He's, you know, lives in Rome, and he's a fancy apartment, and he comes home to his girlfriend, and his girlfriend says, oh, you got a phone call from your mom. And she said, sleepily, she says, oh, she said someone died. And he went, oh yeah, who? And he said, Alfredo. And you could just see, he just turns over on his side, and his face just drops. And you know that, and like he goes into a fetal position, you just know something significant happens. And basically we go on a journey with this man. He's back to his childhood, back in the small Sicilian town, and post World War II, and you know the place is in rubble, really, except for the town square and the cinema, which is the Cinema Paradiso, which overlooks the town square. And the man, the projectionist, the cinema is kind of run by the local parish priest, and the projectionist is a guy called Alfredo, and he's surly and narky and all that sort of jazz. And there's a real great sense of community there. Like, there's so many characters there. They all know each other, and they all know each other's quips and quirks and all that sort of stuff. But This film director, now we go back to his childhood, and he's this little kid, and his nickname is Toto, and he is, as the young child actor who plays him, is probably the cutest kid that's ever been put on film. Like, he's really genuinely precocious, not in an annoying way, but just like, really, I don't know, he's very sincere, and he's got a great personality, and he's also this kid is just passionate. He loves movies more than anything else in the world, and he just wants to get into Alfredo's projection room to be able to see how the projector works. And he's trying to steal, like, you know, little frames off the floor from Alfredo, and Alfredo's like, "Well, this isn't your property," and he's like literally kicking him up the arse down the stairs. And the only way Alfredo can kind of get rid of him is by saying, you know, there's all these, like, there's a big bin full of, like, clips in the corner of the projection booth. And he says, "Well, can I have these?" And Alfredo says, "Right, you can have them, but they have to stay here." And he kind of gets rid of the kid.
Mm.
And what's kind of fun about this kind of setup is that the cinema is run by the local parish priest, and he's censoring, like, every single film that comes in. Like, you know, so he sits there in the audience with a bell, and anytime there's any form of, like, touching or intimacy or nakedness or nudity, like, he rings the bell. Alfredo knows he's got to clip that shot or clip that little scene and stuff like that. And these are the things that pile up in the corner. But anyway, it's what I loved about this film in that first half is that basically the cinema for this community was like their
church.
It was like their living room. It was more like their living room.
Mm-hmm.
They were going in to watch the news. They were going in. Everyone was talking amongst each other. They were watching music videos, like perform music videos. They would watch several movies, and people would come in just to sleep. People were coming in, and they were kind of like getting it on the back and all that sort of jazz. And the whole community went to be entertained in this one place. And there was the film captures this beautiful sense of that, this beautiful sense of place and people, and a kind of a familial love, you know, between them all. And Alfredo's like becomes little Toto's dad, and it's just, you know, everyone there is like, it feels like a cousin, you know, everyone's sitting on top of each other. I think that's what this film captures in the final act, when Toto goes back there, is that sense of over, and like, I cannot state how important Ennio Morricone's score is in this film. Like, without his score, I don't think you at all would get the same emotional potency, but it is absolutely overwhelmingly beautiful, and it just, in another film, it's also overstated. it's also, I feel that Ennio Morricone's scores work really well in a fable like setting, like in the spaghetti westerns. I think his scores are kind of, they fill the room, you know, they don't lie underneath, you know, like lie there quietly, but they fill the room, and I think they work really well. And for me, there's a real potency to his score in this film, where I can just listen to the track, to some of these themes, and just really feel overwhelmed with emotion. Where I'm getting to with this is that basically, when poor old Toto leaves to return back to Rome to his normal life, before he leaves, Alfredo's wife, she said he left something for you.
Mm.
And what it is like a film reel. And he hands the film reel off to a projectionist, who, by the way, is the director, writer-director, Tornatore himself.
Mm.
And the actor playing the director is sitting down in a kind of like a empty screening room, and he sits there and the lights goes down, and he's just kind of like waiting. And all of a sudden, the film kind of clicks in. It starts to count down. We don't see what's on screen, first of all, but what we see, the camera focuses on Toto's face now as a kind of a silver-haired man, and it slowly dollies in on him, and as the hand that was up against his chin starts to drop, as a genuine expression of being overwhelmed is captured on his face, in the same way that the expressions that they captured in the audience's face in the first half of the film watching the movies felt very sincere and very real. And what's been projected on screen was revealed, and it's these old black and white silent clips that poor old Alfredo was forced to snip from the films from back in the day. And what he's done as a blind man is that he spliced the entire thing together. All of these, like, I don't know how many clips he spliced them together.
It just goes on and on, doesn't it? It's like it's it decades of, it's, of kisses.
Yeah,
and
it's all sorts of, it's humorous, it's like there's nudity, but then there's gentle, like, you know, it's all sorts of things. Just whatever the priest deems pornographic, he saved it all, like Charlie Chaplin stuff. But what I found so beautiful about it is that it's a perfectly measured piece of storytelling, because the first interaction we see between Alfredo and little Toto was that Toto said, oh, can I have these pieces of film? And Alfredo says, well, if you leave, you can have them, but they stay with me. And Alfredo, like all these decades later, remembered that, and he kept it together, and he put the energy into cut this beautiful piece of footage together. And it really, for me, is absolutely gorgeous, because it's kind of his only way of, from beyond the grave, to say to Alfredo, like, you know,
this
like,
is what life's
as
all
a
about.
Father, or I feel it's a more intimate thing. It's more simple. It's more like, I love you. It's, I love you, the way a father would say I love you to a son. It's the only thing I can give you. I am using the only set of tools I have right now. And when the man is watching this, his eyes just glisten with tears, with genuine tears and genuine joy and happiness. And Ennio Morricone's score is playing. Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. And I am feeling in this moment what I'm feeling. The tears are, when I watch the scene, are glistening in my eyes. And I'm getting a sense of elation. Like, you know, tears of elation, of my own spirits being lifted. And he's, you know, the filmmaker's taken us from a place where, yes, we were crying tears of
grief,
of despair and grief over the loss of a beloved character, you know, in only a few minutes beforehand. But because of this gift through time, we've been given a beautiful finish where our spirits are lifted, and the credits roll, and we see clips of Alfredo. The first thing we see on the screen is Alfredo as a young man, and he's vivacious and he's cheeky, and it's just glorious and life affirming, and they're happy tears. You're finishing this film with happy tears, Kevin. So that's my long-winded pitch.
It's a lovely scene, and it's so sweet, and it really is a love letter to film as much as anything else. Last week I asked you, have you ever written a sex scene?
Uh-huh.
And I assumed that you wouldn't have, because, you know, what you've written so far, you've written some, for those that don't know, you've written Song of the Sea, co-wrote Angela's Christmas, Wolf Walkers, which is the one that everyone is watching right now, and that's a gorgeous emotive film. And I'm sure you've probably written something that's made you tear up, have you?
The embarrassing answer is yes. I think, yeah, I have written things that have teared me up, and I can actually, weirdly enough, it's such a kind of potent memory of an odd and strange experience of actually tearing up when you're writing a scene. It seems a little bit, in one sense, narcissistic, but also in another sense, it's almost like being in the third person mode, where you're kind of going, oh shit, this is happening, and it's almost like you can see the scene itself unfolding. Like,
you're projecting yourself forward into the future when you're in the audience watching.
You're
the film.
In there. You're feeling the emotion of that scene. Like, I specifically remember writing the big emotional kind of beat in Song of the Sea is at the end when they're saying goodbye to their mom, and she comes back from the dead to like one last kind of message, and they're saying goodbye to her.
let you stay too, Mom? Please?
My son. Remember me in your stories and in your songs. Know that I will always love you. Always.
And I genuinely wrote that with a sense of I need to get this down because it's been said to me. You know, it was that. It
You're
was
being a
to
conduit
that.
For something else.
Yeah, and I'm not being...
When people talk about the zeitgeist and stuff being out there in the ether, I personally 100% believe that at some stage the story wants to tell itself.
Yeah.
And you just have to translate it as fast as you can from what's out there in the ether. And if you don't do it, somebody else will catch that moment and catch that idea that wants to escape whatever intangible region where ideas come from and emotions outside ourselves come from. Mm-hmm. Because of the zeitgeist and because of, like, you know, you write something and somebody else is also writing the exact same thing. And I think stories just try to find the right conduit to travel from one realm into the next. And that sounds all new agey and stuff, but for me, it's the only way that I can explain solving problems that are beyond me, that I never could have practically or rationally figured out, but they just sort of reveal themselves. And it's like divine intervention where I
you
created a problem. Yeah, I created a problem and the solution solved itself through the natural flow of the story. And crying with writing things, I can totally believe it being, you know, that outside yourself third person sort of vibe. It's true for me when I'm writing anyway.
And another thing I've learned from having kind of like done it and like all of my produced scripts in one way, shape or another, is that anytime I never ever go into any of these scripts intending or knowing this is going to be the big emotional moment, this is going to be the big emotional scene, you know, I always go in thinking, well, how am I going to write this? And once I truly can feel it like on top of me or in me or coming out of me. And anytime I feel that when writing a script, I now know, because I've been through the process, that that emotion somehow gets across to a reader, somehow gets across to a director, somehow gets across to an actor, and if all, and an editor and the composer, and somehow that emotion is like passed like a Chinese whisper and ends up in the eyes and ears of an audience, and they feel that emotion that I felt someone was telling me to write, or the characters were telling me to say when I was transcribing the scene. It sounds crazy, but that's the best way I can describe it to me.
And I know exactly what you mean in terms of it feeling natural, because when you try to force that stuff, it just doesn't work. It just feels like bad karaoke that's heard through a thick wall. It's undefined and it doesn't sound as good.
And writing an emotional scene as well, It's like you've got a limited number of those bullets in a whole film. Like the whole, it's like once you've like released that catharsis, that emotional catharsis in a film, it's very hard to reload the story, reload the audience in kind of like, you know, you're building up to this kind of like emotional release. And once it's released, you know, it's, you only get one shot and you got to get it right in a film. You can over-egg it. It can be overplayed. It can be underplayed. But I think the worst thing is if it's overplayed. I think that's where it can go really wrong for you.
Where the sentimentality feels very plastic and Hallmark.
Yeah, yeah. Anytime I've ever been told this scene should have people crying, and it's never worked. Absolutely never. It's always just fallen flat and just not being sincere. There's one specific thing on Wolfwalkers. There's two scenes that still give me goosebumps in Wolfwalkers. And it's, this is spoiler stuff. But there's one scene where the little girl Maeve, her mammy is kind of asleep in a coma in a cave. And she returns to her mammy after basically making friends with this girl, excited, saying, "Mammy, I've made friends with this girl." And when I wrote that scene, I remember. And it was subtle. It wasn't big. It was basically her being really excited and telling her mammy that this is, you know, isn't it great? I've got this new friend. But then the mood changing, and she then goes from being this, you know, excited girl, delighted that she's got a new friend, to being a girl who's worried about her mammy.
Made a new friend, mammy.
Matoni.
But a nice one. Her name is Robin. She's taller than me, but I'm stronger. And she brushed my hair and gave me this flower. And she's from a place called England. And we're going to meet by the oak tree tomorrow. And she promised to help. And where are you? He promised you'd come back. But it's been so long now. Are you lost? Has something happened to you? Robin will help me find you, Mammy. She promised. There's two of us now.
I remembered it in the line of dialogue. When I wrote the lines of dialogue, I remember getting the kind of the chill up the back of my spine, feeling this poor girl. I didn't feel like, oh, this is going to work for the audience. I went, this poor girl. I felt sorry for her, you know? And then we didn't really change it through the process. And when we came to the day of the record, little Eva Whittaker, the actress, she was her first time doing anything like this. She does her first read-through of that chunk of dialogue. And I remember she played it perfectly of the excitement. And then when she got to those final few sentences, she knew how to... She played the perfect note where I started to well up. I was sitting across from her, a few feet away from her. And I looked across at the directors and we're all welling up. And no one ever said this is going to be. No one ever said this is how this should be played. No one ever did. She played it that way,
yeah.
And it's amazing. It was just like magic to me. I just went, "Wow, that's that." Because we all knew it was real to us, you know.
You were talking about scenes that would make you tear up, but you talking about that had me tearing up because that's like the stuff that you dream of as a screenwriter. It's to sort of capture those emotions. And to send them out into the world and to hope and to pray that other people will be able to hear what it is you're trying to do and that it will be received by audiences. And those are really special moments. And yeah, I'm so glad I asked you because that's beautiful.
So that was my best tearjerker scene. I went for a fairly conventional one. I was going to go esoteric. But I just went, you know what, I'm going to go for one that was a very seminal kind of tearjerker scene for me. And so I chose Cinema Paradiso, and I'm not going to apologize for that.
Don't.
Kevin, I'm so sorry. Kevin, it's okay. It's okay. It's
all
right,
broken
Kevin.
Me.
Listen, it's good to
last
cry.
Last week you said, did you need a cigarette after that? And no, I need a therapist after that.
But think of, this is just, you're releasing the stress toxins, Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to feel so much better once you've got this. Get it all out, buddy. Get it. No, take that snot. No, just use the tissue for the snot. There we go. Yeah.
Done.
Now, very good. And, shall we get on with business, Kevin?
Let's do it. Let's figure out what next week's going to be.
Okay, so now that we have the tearjerker behind us and that's in the bag, it is now our duty and our role to figure out what Kevin's topic is going to be for next week. And I have a big wheel ahead of me. So, Kevin, are you ready for me to spin the wheel?
I am. I'm too messy. I said it right
still
this
haven't.
Time.
I still haven't looked that word up.
At least I got it right this time.
You say it. Okay, here we go. I'm going to spin the wheel. So we're spinning.
I don't know why you get nervous.
Spin- Best musical number scene, Kevin.
Okay.
Best musical number scene. How does that sound to you as a topic?
That sounds like I have a lot of research to do.
Yeah. But
it'll
it's going to be great to listen to.
Jukebox episode.
Yeah, musical number scene. So, hang on a second. So this is like, you're going to musicals, obviously. First port to call. Would that be it? That's it?
I would, yes. Musicals, I'm thinking going right back to Gene Kelly. I'm thinking fun songs.
Yeah.
Something that I would listen to over and over again or watch over and over again.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to have to dig into that.
So many.
There's so many.
There's so many. Aren't there? That's the problem.
There's too many.
And then there's
got so much homework
contemporary
to do.
Ones. And then there's regular films that kind of just throw in a musical number just to be awkward.
Like what?
Like Blazing Saddles. Get off your hands. Da-da-da-da. I don't know the words, but remember, put on your hands, push out your tush. Love that one.
Well, then now we know what your favorite musical number is.
Well, you put me on the spot, so.
Well, then next week, best musical number.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it, Kevin.
I'm just having a visual image of the opening to Temple of Doom.
Oh, God. Oh, man. Yeah. The scene that... Anyway, that's a story for another day.
We'll save it. We'll save it for next week.
I've got a story to tell. Kevin, are we going to do our where can people find us thing?
Oh, people can find us on Twitter under at BestBitsPod. And both our handles are under there. But I'm... at Kevin Lee Han, and you are.
I am Willems Fillum, WILLUMSFILLUM.
Awesome.
On Twitter.
Check us out on there, and please subscribe and all that good stuff, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, good luck, thank you.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lads' latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Play dumb and stupid.
Two fun guys. Two fun guys.
Kevin and Will.
Kevin and Will.
So what's the story, Kevin? It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. You've got news. Tell us your news. Hello, everybody. This is Kevin, and I'm joined by Will, and this is Minibit 72, just in case we didn't say so. I wonder what theme tune I'll put at the beginning of this. I've recorded so many of them. I usually just take my pick when I go for the I go for the egotistical one or the epic one or the 80s synthwave one or the cowboy and western one. We'll see. Depends on the mood of this mini bit.
Okay. I'm looking forward to hearing which one it is. I'm curious because you said to me, you've got news.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, what fucking news do I have?
You nearly died during the week. That is pretty monumental.
There it is. There's me dying right there on mic. Yeah, I almost died. Yeah, I almost died.
Because of the Discord.
It was the Discord, yeah. It was the Discord's fault.
What happened? Tell me what happened.
Yeah.
Because we haven't actually spoken in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Since the Irish episode recording, we haven't been on mic together.
Do you want to talk about this? We can cut it out if you want to.
I do want it to be at the front of, you know, the way we have this, you know, the tag.
We'll save that.
So I'll talk about it later. I'll talk about it later in the episode. You know, we can talk about something else, but I'm quite happy to put it later for our special people.
Okay. Well, listen, I saw these questions on TikTok during the last few weeks, and I thought, those are good questions. I'm going to make a note of them. I'm going to ask Will some of them. So I've got about five of them here. They're quite philosophical.
Okay.
And maybe if I ask you one as the teaser of this episode, and then we can pepper out the other one. Right. See how you get on.
Okay.
So give me from one to five, a number from one to five.
Go. Let's go five. Let's go all five.
Question five. If you could, would you rather spend a day with your younger self or your older self? Take your time.
No.
It's live radio.
This is a Back to the Future question.
Right? Is it?
Am I talking to my older self and my older self going, hey kid, bet on the Sox?
Would you sooner meet up with your older self and get the wisdom of your older self to say to you what you probably need to hear now, which is get a shift on, get a wiggle on? Or would you sooner go back to your younger self and say, listen, that thing that you're worried about or that thing that you don't do and you should have done, you know, give him a pointer or some sort of a steer. So it's whether you want
is
the steer
it going to work
or do you
out?
Want to give your younger self a steer. Forgetting about the ramifications and the consequences. Forget all the sort of the grandfather paradox. For those that don't know what the grandfather paradox is, go back to our time travel episode.
Yeah. All right. I think I'll go back to my younger self, right? And I'll say, you know, I'll ask my younger self, come here, what's the big worry? What are you worried about? And
you should know that.
But I'm
don't
going to
you
ask,
remember what you're worried about?
But the specific thing, because I worry about so many things. You know, we all worry about various different things, you know, from, you know.
Losing your Spider-Man shoes.
Yes. I'm going to go, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because
it'll
guess
be good
what?
Content.
Next week, you're going to have Batman. You're going to have Batman willies.
Also,
right?
In the future, there's a thing called a podcast. And you'll be able to tell people what happened to your Spider-Man shoes on the podcast.
Exactly. It's all the bad shit that's happening to you will be, it's filling you up and it will be good content. That's all it is. All that embarrassing stuff that you do is going to be all right as long as you don't be too much of a prick and just stay the course. That's kind of it.
I'd be the opposite.
No, I think I would have a nice little sit down.
You'd have what? A nice shit?
I'd have a nice sit down and a nice little chat with myself. That's what I would do. How would you do? You're saying you would do the opposite.
I'd do the opposite. I'd want to speak to my future self because I can enact whatever they tell me. So I can, you know, live in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know. I'd like foresight. Tell me what is coming towards me or what I need to be aware of. And I will make the change now because I can. Going back to my younger self, I would just be unburdening my younger self. And then, I don't know, hoping that that would change the course of my life. But I'm very happy with my life. I think everything's turned out fantastic. So I wouldn't want to risk changing anything. So, yeah.
Honestly, that was my first thought as well. I was like, going, yeah, I want all the information my older self can give me. And but I was like, I'll go back and I'll kind of help my younger self out a little bit.
When you hit 65, your prostate is going to blow up like a basketball.
Yeah. I didn't want to talk to my older self because what if my oldest self is 37? You know, I only live, you know, another 2 years. I'm implying I'm 35 right now.
I was going to say, I was like getting confused there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said I needed to put some clarity on that one. I would be afraid for my older self to come back and my older self go, come back and I see the state of him and I go, oh shit, just one look at my older self and go, oh fuck no.
Listen, I just had the camera angled wrong there when I turned on the webcam here and that's already rattled me. I'm like, oh God.
You should never have the camera pointed at your balls, Kevin. Never, ever, ever, ever.
That's how I make a living. $5.99 a month. Well, listen, that will do as a teaser. Yes, go on. Thank you to everybody that's listened to the latest episode, which we haven't recorded yet, and I hope it was a good episode, because I have no fucking clue what I'm going to talk about on that episode. But we've already done it now, because you've heard us talking about it. But also, this might be one of the random episodes. So, this is the Patreon. We do the mini bits. Come along. They're great episodes. We're going to keep talking, though. See ya.
Fuck them.
Yeah, fuck that.
Fuck that.
Bye.